Good evening and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program here on September 5th, 2013. I'm your host, David Katzmar, coming to you live as I do every Thursday night at 8 p.m. New York time and 5 p.m. Pacific. Tonight, what a special program we have for all of those of you interested in the cycles of change and how it affects us all. Joining us is Peter Atwater to discuss socionomics and the market. Peter Atwater was called one of the smartest guys you never heard of on anything financial by Herb Greenberg of CNBC. Peter is president of Financial Insights. That's Insights with a Y, not an I. A consulting firm that advises institutional investors, corporations, and public policymakers on how social mood affects decision-making in the markets. After a successful career in financial services, including 13 years with J.P. Morgan building that firm's asset-backed securities business, and executive leadership roles at First USA, Bank One, and Juniper, Peter turned his attention to socionomics, how changes in social mood alter human behavior. Today, through his firm, Financial Insights, he brings a practical understanding of the world of finance coupled with a keen awareness of how human decision-making, enabling his clients to easily see changing behavioral trends ahead of the market. Peter teaches an honors colloquium at the University of Delaware titled Social Mood, Decision-Making, and the Markets, and he is the author of Moods and Markets on FT Press, which this provides specific practical insights for investors on how changes in confidence drive the capital markets. Peter's research on confidence-driven decision-making has been profiled by Gillian Tett of the Financial Times and Rana Furuhar in Time magazine. Peter graduated with honors from the College of William and Mary in 1983 with a BA in economics, and he's a member of Phi Beta Kappa. He currently serves on the board and chairs the finance committee of the William and Mary Foundation, the college's endowment. You can find out more at financial-insights.com. That's insights with a Y, not an I, financial-insights.com. And so here to join us and tell us a little bit about what is socionomics is Peter Atwater. Peter, are you there?
I'm there, David. Thank you.
All right, Peter, this is a fascinating subject and certainly one that tells a little bit about our mass consciousness. Are we, in fact, moving with a herd mentality, Peter?
Absolutely. You know, socionomics is really all about how do herds behave, and it is remarkable how consistently human behavior repeats itself in its cycles of confidence.
Yes.
Go ahead.
You've seen that in the market then, have you? Have you been able to decipher patterns?
Over and over. What I particularly like are the patterns that you see at peaks and troughs in confidence. In peaks of confidence, you know, when a stock or a sector or even the entire market is peaking, you see very similar attributes. I describe it often as middle school all over again, because there is a very strident, loud, unified voice where you are either in the right crowd or you're a loser. You know, you saw that with gold, particularly in the summer of 2011. You see it over and over with Apple last fall, where you know that the herd gets very, very fierce and one-sided. But there are other aspects to it as well that you know you can see in the world around you. With corporations, there's nothing better to me than you know a brand new headquarters building being announced, and certainly Apple met that bill, you know, with its spaceship headquarters that it announced right about the time the stock was peaking. You also see incredible complexity where companies particularly overreach in how they're organized, the products and services they offer, I think Boeing is a great example of that, where, you know, at its peak in confidence, it, you know, it developed a whole new manufacturing scheme for the 787. And, you know, we're obviously seeing, you know, the other side of that with the issues that have arisen in its manufacturing process.
The question is, when we're riding on a tide, we're really surfing on it, we're riding high, we want to catch the momentum. How do we know when that tide is going to turn? Tricky question.
It's remarkable to me how you can see it, particularly in the media. Let me give you a real recent example. The Indian markets, the rupee and the Sensex. You know, the week before that market bottomed, you saw this enormous flurry of media activity. You know, everybody was talking about it. And I love it when we're all, you know, focused on the same thing, because that's an indicator of a change in markets. Mm. Now, one of the other things you see, particularly at bottoms in markets, is a lot of related social anxiety. In the summer of 2011, for example, when the FTSE, the British stock market, was bottoming, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you saw riots. The same thing with the Brazilian markets when they bottomed. When the Australian market bottomed earlier this year, they voted out the prime minister. Her own party kicked her out. At the bottom of the market in 2009, all of a sudden the Tea Party came out of nowhere. And in October 2011, when that market was bottoming, you saw Occupy Wall Street. So to me, there are lots of things that you can see at market bottoms when that lack of confidence that you see in the markets is being exhibited elsewhere around you.
And this is a fascinating correlation between social behavior, group patterns, many people focusing on the same thing, as opposed to just following the technicals and looking for moving averages and what's happening on the charts and so forth. So in other words, how we feel and how we think and how we buy and sell are all interconnected. Is that what you're finding?
Absolutely. Confidence, our level of confidence permeates everything we do. You know, Bob Prechter has looked at the relationship between the stock market and the movies we watch. You know, there's the hemline index, which shows that as confidence rises in the markets, skirt lengths rise. One of the topics that I'm personally fascinated with is food choices. When our confidence is low, we're eating local foods. The whole locavore movement, farm-to-table, microbreweries, artisan bakery, that kind of dining is indicative of low periods of confidence. One of the things that I have found in the research that I've done in terms of trying to really simplify this for folks is to think about, when our confidence is low, it is all about me here now. It's as if we wear variable lens goggles, in which our level of confidence drives our perspective. And so I'm looking for, at bottoms in confidence, examples of self-interest, of, you know, local decision making taking precedent over national or international. So, you know, the focus on secession, for example, would be, you know, a collective exhibition of me here now. And the same thing with time horizon choices, where people are making, you know, very short term decisions and ignoring anything to do with long term planning. Conversely, at peaks in confidence, it's us everywhere forever. It's a completely different series of preferences and choices. We're much nicer to each other. We're generous financially, socially. We're all about compromise and being a centrist, trying to find solutions that benefit everybody. We're making commitments that extend for long periods of time, and we're extrapolating the good times forever. So it's a very different way of looking at things for people who are in the markets. And I don't look at technical charts. I don't look at what most economists look at as they're projecting the future. I'm merely looking at how are we behaving outside of the markets, because that will tell me the direction of where we're going.
Absolutely, and I quite agree with you, and I think there is a correlation. It's a very emotional index, and when we're optimistic, we're outgoing, we're speculative, we're looking ahead to the future. When we're pessimistic, we pull up the drawbridge, and we do become localized and self-centric. Absolutely, and this is going to be reflected on whether we're speculative buying or whether we just don't have the confidence to go into the market. The hemline index, I like that term. That's very true. And the how brightly colored automobiles and clothing are, and whether neckties are wide and lapels are wide or not, seem to coincide with our rise and fall in confidence and so forth. So, Peter, my question is this a pattern of ups and downs that we can see anything we do by watching everything we do, but are these patterns the sequence of events that can happen with any amount of time for them to go through the sequence time and time again, or is this something that has highs and lows with periodicity? Is there a rhythm as well as a sequential pattern going on in our chain?
Yes, there is a rhythm to it. But I would say the rhythm is fractal based. Mm. So you have, cycles within cycles. And what you're looking for as an investor, there are traders, for example, who might be thinking about intraday cycles in confidence. Other people are thinking about, weeks, months, years, decades. I think, for example, the confidence that we exhibited at the peak of the dot-com bubble in 1999 and 2000, that was the peak of a cycle that we hadn't seen since the late 1920s. Uh-huh. This incredible change in technology and commensurate valuations with that. So I would say yes, there are cycles to this, but there are you can see smaller cycles, from 1930, the market bottom in 33, through to 2000. It's certainly not one straight line.
True. And I quite agree that there are cycles within cycles within cycles, that there is a fractal relationship. It's interesting that you mentioned the dot-com bust and the peak of the market just before the stock market crash of the 1920s, because I believe there's a 36-year emotional cycle moving in our country that began since our country was born in the American Revolution. And if you look at the peak times of this cycle, it peaked in 1928. You mentioned mm-hmm. the late 20s, and that was right. We were over-speculating at that time because we were running away with our emotions and believing that not only can you make a profit in the market, but you should. Everybody should. Well, you better watch out for that, because the following year we were due for a crisis because of where the other cycles were. Crisis comes in with periodicity, I believe. And then it peaked another time in the year 2000. Also, at the same time, that there was another cycle crossing up in 1999 to 2000, put those two things together, over speculation with an emotional peak, and due for a crisis in the physical cycles. And then what you're going to have is things go buff because we were believing in things that weren't founded and they didn't have any substance to it. And in between the 28 peak and the 2000 peak was the 1964 peak, mm-hmm. according to this theory. of a 36-year cycle, and that's when we had Beatlemania, we had a wildly expansive market, we had the mod era, we had the hippie movement, we had the wild music, and we had all of the wild time we call the 60s. So I do believe there's a rhythm, too, to this. And I couldn't agree with you more that by watching social behavior, you can find patterns in the market. Now, is this true for all nations, Peter? Well, we see it here.
Yeah. You know, last fall, I was watching the tension between China and Japan, because that was a really powerful indicator of a major market bottom in Asia. You know, two countries, you know, two developed nations fighting, you know, vociferously and vigorously over, you know, a small series of islands. And you had, you know, in China, strong nationalistic behavior, people overturning Japanese cars and, you know, indications of again, me here now behavior.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it really does transcend cultures and nationalities.
When we look at how different countries can have cycles that rise and fall, do we sometimes have striking contrast when one cycle is at a very high and another country has its cycles very low? When you look at the relationship between Japan and the United States in the 1960s, Americans regard anything made in Japan as something of a joke. It was the mass importer of cheap goods, and they would consider them, well, just cheap imitations. Lo and behold, United States, a couple of decades later in the 1980s, was looking to Japan for leadership as we were seeking new business models because they were competing against us by selling competition to our products in our own market. And they did it brilliantly. And before long, they were buying Rockefeller Center, and they were importing automobiles and so forth. And then, but after that, that flip-flopped again. And while we were getting stronger coming up during the 1990s, they were going down. And so it seems like we were just on opposite ends of the seesaw. Maybe it's because we have a rhythm within us that's in a different synchrony than the rhythm they have inside of them. Is such a thing something that can happen between nations?
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, the international correlations are not perfect market to market. In fact, that's been one of the arguments for, you know, global diversification, is one nation is doing well while another nation is suffering. So I do think there is, you know, clear opportunity for, you know, cycle differences around the globe. You know, that said, you do see strong regional cycles, particularly in the Middle East, and even, I would say, you know, North America, Canada, and the United States, very similar cycles.
No, you're not just an academician, Peter. You're putting this theory into practice. Can you tell us a little bit about Financial Insights, your website, what people can find there and what it's on the web for?
Yeah, my focus through my firm is helping money managers who are interested in, you know, the impact of changes in confidence to, you know, particular investments that they may have. I also do work with corporations, because if you can see where the cycles are going, you have a very good opportunity to project what is going to happen in terms of corporate behavior. So, for example, you know, with the decline in confidence in Europe, it was very easy to be advising corporations that the risks that they would face would be a breakdown in the free mobility of labor, goods, and services and capital within the Eurozone. And, you know, you saw changes in immigration law. You saw, you know, the potential for a Eurozone breakup. Those are very logical when you're seeing confidence fall, because organizations naturally come apart. So it's helpful for corporations who are thinking strategically to be looking at how their own businesses correlate to changes in confidence. You know, corporations spend millions of dollars a year looking at their, you know, their exposure to interest rates or to commodity prices. From my perspective, they're missing the big picture because of how they're correlated to changes in confidence. And this obviously has big impact to different marketing strategies. If you are a global brand trying to sell a product in a period of weak social mood, you want to find ways to customize and tailor your message to a particular local market. And the other group that I advise are policymakers, because they are increasingly interested in how changes in confidence affect diplomatic relations, military relations, even issues of national security. If you look, for example, at the Egyptian stock market and were to overlay major Middle East terrorist attacks, you would see a very clear correlation between when the Middle East markets bottomed and when major terrorism occurred.
Indeed, indeed. Now, is this cause and effect, or are both things possibly being caused by the same third thing?
Well, confidence is both an input and an output of everything we do. And so to me, this question of chicken and egg, cause and effect, I think is really not important. What is important is that in a particular moment, our level of confidence has already factored in those, that constant cycling of cause and effect, output and input. And so it's a state of being. And so I think it's part of the reason that it is so saturating in everything we do, because our brain doesn't distinguish between input and output when it comes to confidence. We just know how we feel.
Indeed. And we can't underestimate the emotional factor, because when we are getting too close to the canvas to really see the painting, and we're only following what the market is doing, and that's what technical analysis does. It doesn't really forecast. It tells you what the market is doing, and from that you have to extrapolate. But when you're looking, when you step away and you really look at everything that's going on around you, one of the reasons why I think that we get big surprises in the market is because we're underestimating the emotional factor. And if we realize that emotion is not just a reaction to something, but it is a thing in itself. It's something that we can observe. Behavior is something that we can study and must factor in as a major reason for some of our decisions. And we cannot overlook that when we're trying to follow the market. Now, you were going to say.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Your book, Moods and Markets, fascinating subject, and one that's been overlooked painfully in 1929 and certainly hit us with a hard shock in 1973 and gave us another jab in 2000. And I think mood had a lot to do with that. But what was your motivation for writing Moods and Markets, Peter? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I had been, after the banking crisis, I'd spent a lot of time looking at what the contributing causes of the crisis were. And I had that sense, and honestly still have that sense, that for the most part, we're reenacting that classic tale of the six blind men and the elephant. One man holds the tail and thinks it's a snake, another person holds a leg and thinks it's a tree. As I kept filtering and filtering the history, I stumbled across work that had been done by Robert Prechter. Bob does a lot of work looking at Elliott wave formations in the market, fractals, but he's also done extraordinary work in socionomics I've said to Bob, I have the luxury of driving on a road that he carved out of a jungle. But what, as I kept looking at issues around me, particularly for the banking crisis, they kept coming back to confidence and how does confidence change our choices. And so my real focus was trying to find a way that the average person without any background in the markets could make better choices as an investor by understanding how confidence affects us. And particularly for investors, our innate confidence-driven behaviors lead us to consistently make the wrong investment choice every time. You know, at the bottom of the markets, when our confidence is low, our survival instinct is saying, you know, sell, 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 sell.
Yes.
And yet, that is precisely the time we should be buying.
You're absolutely right. And what about the press that's out there? You know, if you read Wall Street Journal quotes or you read Barron's magazines, and I'm not trying to single anybody out, are some of the things that you'll pick up and read in the periodicals something of a reverse barometer at times? Or are they pretty on?
Absolutely. They're precisely a reverse barometer. You know, last week when the markets bottomed, if you just read the headlines in the Wall Street Journal, so a week ago Wednesday, every headline was negative in the first 5 or 6 pages of the paper. Yeah. They were talking about secession. They were talking about the Tea Party. In fact, I used the headlines from the Wall Street Journal with my clients because I knew before I turned on the TV that the market was going to bottom that day just based on the sentiment that I saw in the paper.
That's a good observation. And things never look worse than when they're at the bottom, which is when it's about to go up. And things never look better than when you're at the top of the Ferris wheel and we know what's coming after that. You know, one concept about the press and everything that's selling economic news is their main thing is not necessarily prediction. It's selling more papers or more magazines or more subscriptions to online blogs and what have you. And they have to sell what people will believe. And so when we look at the consumer will buy bad news right at the bottom. It's about to get better and vice versa. So, and you look at, now, speaking of reverse barometers, most of the people who speculate in the market tend to get that wrong. If you look at isn't the put-call ratio often been viewed as a reverse barometer of where the market's going to go?
Yes, it's a fabulous contrarian indicator because people are
most
buying
people
puts. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's tricky, but it's interesting. So we have to follow the holistic view. You know, kind of get in touch with our social feelings, as it were. So. Now, you've been studying this for a long time, haven't you, Peter?
I've been studying this for about 5 years.
Yes.
You know, I've been involved in the markets my entire career, but this has really been an entire focus for the past 5 years.
Indeed. And you're finding people are getting more interested in this? Are they starting to look outside of the box a little bit more and looking for answers other than what is going to be found with a pencil? Are they starting to take a little more emotional intelligence, a little bit more awareness about all of us moving together as they try to make their decisions about how other people are making their decisions in the market?
They are. I think that, you know, the world of economists has been seriously discredited by the financial crisis. You know, so few economists were saying that, you know, there are problems ahead. You know, the same thing with a lot of folks in regulation and public policy. And so there is a real searching for new ways to, you know, project and to understand the world around us, and I think socionomics is one of them.
Yeah, and I think it might reflect that people are becoming a little bit more socially aware and having a little bit more, you know, compassion when they're looking at the world around them. Folks, you're listening to the Cycles of Change radio program here. We're speaking with Peter Atwater on the subject of socionomics. He's author of the book Mood and Markets, and he's a financial advisor with a rich history. You can find his site at financial-insights.com. That's insights with a Y, not an I. Financial-insights.com. Well, Peter, we've established that there are patterns in group behavior. We have a herd mentality. There is a rhythm in our behavior. It's something that moves as national trends. All nations have them. The trends of one nation can be in one position, rising or falling, while the trends of another nation could be in a different position, maybe even going in a different direction. But that our moods really play an important role in our decision-making. We can't underestimate the confidence factor. So, Peter, how do you see where we are now? We've certainly been through a lot in the last decade plus, but what is the general mood and confidence level of the United States right now?
Confidence is still quite negative, but there's some really important sort of subcategories that are worth discussing, because as I look at American confidence, I see two very distinct patterns. The pattern that I see for those with financial assets, whether they are significant holdings of bonds or equities, they are displaying extraordinarily high confidence today. Mm. I see it in, you know, things like Maserati sales up 50% from a year ago. The luxury condominium market in New York is on fire. You know, it seems like every day I see yet another, you know, 50, 60, 70 story tall condominium building being, you know, being discussed. The art world having very strong auctions. So the very financial elite are behaving as you would expect them to behave, with extreme high confidence. On the other side, as you go down the economic, you know, the socioeconomic levels, what you're seeing is absolutely no improvement in confidence since 2009. The people without are, you know, continuing to exhibit, you know, all of the negative weak social mood indicators. And so not surprising that you see, you know, continued discussions around secession, around, you know, gun control and gun policy, immigration reform. So it's a very binary, you know, polarized confidence environment that is in place today.
Bit of a centrifuge right now. Different layers and different strata feeling in different ways. And with a 36-year emotional cycle, going back to that theory, because I believe that's the one influences confidence more than anything else. Peaked in 1928, 36 years later. Peaked in 1964, 36 years later. Peaked in the year 2000. So if it's a 36-year cycle, it has nine-year quarters. And after it peaks in 2000, it would come down to the mid-range and cross into the low 9 years later. And that happened in 2009. And what's interesting is whenever a cycle crosses the mid-range is when it goes through a transitional period of crisis, not at the peak so much or at the trough as much. Those are distinct qualities of their own. But a time of sudden turmoil and upset seems to come at the equator of the sinusoidal wave. And that downward turn of the emotional high came in the year 2009, and the emotional cycle is declining ever since. Sorry, I put a little bit of a theory in there. I'm not ascribing this theory to you, Peter, but it's a viewpoint that I have, that we do have a 36-year cycle in confidence, and it seems consistent with the observations that you're keenly making, having your finger on the pulse and working with active clients. And I think that that cycle is going to continue to decline, and some other cycles are going to continue to decline. And between now and 2020, I don't know, Peter, it looks like we might have a real decline in confidence between now and then. Are there some reasons why I might be incorrect about that, or I should be optimistic between now and 2020, Peter?
Well, there's another cycle that I want to talk about, because I think this too is going to be weighing on confidence, and that is the cycle that we've seen in interest rates from 1982 until last summer, which was a 30-year cycle of falling interest rates. And what is important to me in that is that associated with that has been a 30-year cycle of rising confidence in the Federal Reserve. You know, when Paul Volcker took over the Fed, if you read some of his early testimony to Congress, he's quite explicit that markets were betting against the effectiveness of the Fed and the willingness of Congress to act.
Yeah.
And I think of that, you know, early 1980s point as reflecting extraordinary weak confidence in Washington.
Yes.
We saw a very powerful peak in confidence last summer in interest rates. And with that, you know, the sense of extraordinary omnipotence in the Federal Reserve. You know, investors were, from my perspective, front-running the Fed. They were so convinced that the Fed was going to do what they wanted that they were acting ahead of the Fed to in reflection of their confidence. My worry is that, and what we're seeing is that as interest rates have been rising, we're seeing deteriorating confidence in central banks, and not just the Federal Reserve, but I would say, you know, global central banks in general. And I think that is something that I'm watching because of its implications to overall economic confidence.
We certainly hit a trough in 1982. In fact, it was in the year 1982 that the 36-year cycle hit the very bottom. After the downward crossover of 1973, that crisis, two cycles crossed down 1973, and we all know what happened then. I'm not going to recount all about the president resigning, the oil crisis, and shakeups in the FBI and CIA and everything else. But it rose after that. Now, what I have been noticing is a massive consolidation of banks, banks buying banks, buying banks and everything. And when I drive down the road, it seemed everywhere there was construction of a new bank office opening here, opening there. That's been going on in the past decade. What's been happening with banks since the century began, Peter? Are they becoming consolidated more? Are they starting to separate and become more local? What's a general trend? What's a direction?
The general trend, you know, you're right. You know, at the same time that you were experiencing the dot-com move, you know, boom, you also had massive consolidation. So the mergers of Bank One and First Chicago, the mergers of Bank of America and Nations Bank. And then you had one more large series of mergers, you know, just before the market peak in 2007. You know, since then, there were forced consolidations during the banking crisis, you know, Bank of America buying Merrill Lynch, you know, J.P. Morgan and Bear Stearns and Washington Mutual. But there is no doubt in my mind that the weak confidence that we are experiencing today is bringing with it a preference for smaller, simpler, more local banks. And that trend, I don't think, has finally reached its, you know, reached its peak, because we have not seen a huge social outcry for you know, breaking up the banks in some, you know, in some specific form. And people talk about Glass-Steagall and breaking them up by, you know, bank and brokerage. I don't know that that will be ultimately, you know, how banks are simplified. But that's our goal. We want smaller, simpler, more transparent, more local, you know, financial institutions.
It does seem to have a little bit more appeal that way. When we're rising, we tend to follow behind the leader. And that's when we have we're set precedents and we consolidate and we conform to standards. And that's when you see everybody getting behind the same, following the same music. But yeah, after the peak, that's when things go into variation. They splinter off, they branch out, and whatnot. And sometimes it's also because we're withdrawing. So I think we've seen the end of consolidation and standardization and everything like that. And it's going to be more variation. Now, we've focused a lot here on the United States. Is there you spoke of a fractal relationship of cycles. You went all the way down to intraday, and there are people who will follow things on longer terms, and there's patterns that we can observe that take so many years. We talked about them in terms of decades here. If we look at the fractal relationship of cycles affecting our moods, can we see something on the global arena? Can we see a correlation between the Dark Ages would rise in the Renaissance and then give us the Baroque era and the Romantic era that might decline in the Victorian era or the rise of the Industrial Revolution? Are all of these things perhaps acting out the very same patterns that we can see in our own lifetime by watching the people around us, that we can see in centuries passing of the ages and the worldwide trends?
Absolutely. I mean, if you were to look, for example, at the behaviors of, you know, Venice at its peak, you know, that age of exploration, the consistency of that kind of high level of confidence, you know, you see it playing out elsewhere in history. You know, the times we go to the moon, we implement, you know, international air travel. We go west, young man, in, you know, the late 1840s. I mean, those cycles absolutely repeat through history. And again, you see it in music. You see it in art. You see it in politics. The same kinds of confidence-driven behaviors play out. You know, Mark Twain is right. You know, history may not repeat, but it sure rhymes.
He's absolutely right. So we can pretty much look at a civilization, whether it's a national civilization or the global community, as having characteristics of a person? Does it have a character? Can the world have a bad day?
Yeah, the world can have a bad day. You know, particularly as, you know, behaviors get transmitted, globally. You know, we for example, think of 9/11 as being something that caused our markets to crash.
Yeah.
I look at 9/11 in the framework of Middle East stock exchanges, and it was a enormous low in the Egyptian stock market. And so, you know, there's a circumstance where low confidence is manifesting in, you know, horrible behavior in a whole different part of the world.
Yes. Yes, and being projected to another nation.
And you know, another example going the other direction, if you look at the decision to go into Iraq, it mm-hmm. timed, you know, within the week of a major market bottom.
Yes. Yes, it did. There is also the physical cycle that influences our industry. I believe that's a 28-year cycle. That bottomed out in 1992. Both Ford and General. Now, we were already in Iraq, but if you're
I'm thinking more 2002, 2003.
Oh,
that
the latter.
Decision.
Yes. Yeah. And we certainly had a debt with the .com and everything like that. And a classic example is the terrible economic conditions in Germany. Reports of taking a wheelbarrow of money to buy a loaf mm-hmm. of bread. And so they decided that they were going to solve their problems by expansionist movements, and they decided they convert to a growth-dependent nation that then solve their economic woes. So
economists talk about, you know, the Second World War is taking us out of the Great Depression, and I would look at it differently as a socionomist to say war is the outcome of collective weak social mood. You know, that's when we, you know, bottoms to me are defined by acts of sacrifice. We abhor uncertainty more than we crave certainty, and so as confidence deteriorates, we get to the point where we must do something to change the future. And, you know, oftentimes that something is not nice.
It's a fascinating thing you said, Peter. We abhor uncertainty more than we crave certainty.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me wonder if we were to focus more on the positive alternative rather than reacting to a bad situation, our decision-making might change.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it in the patterns of the markets. You know, tops of markets tend to be very rounded. We hold on to what we think is certain for as long as we possibly can. We're kind of like a cat being dragged across carpet. At the bottoms are very V-shaped. It's horrible. Get me out. And so it's that distinction between that sense of what we crave and what we hate.
Indeed. If we look ahead for the remainder of this century, are there any tides, any patterns that we can see, any lessons that we may have learned that would give us an indication as to how this century might differ from the one that we just came from, Peter? Tough question, I realize that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we are, because of the significance of the 2000 peak, I think that, you know, this is going to be a period of uncertainty that goes longer than people ever imagined possible. And, you know, I remind my clients that when it comes to economic recessions, it's not the depth of the recession that matters. It is its length of time.
Mm.
You can hold your breath underwater for a minute, whether you're a foot underwater or 50 feet underwater.
Yes.
But we all drown in 6 inches of water after some period of time. And so my concern in this protracted and prolonged period of very weak confidence is the level of financial, emotional exhaustion that is occurring. You know, people are holding on as long as they can, but many are ultimately, you know, falling victim to this very protracted period of economic malaise and weak confidence.
And for those of us who are weary, it's bad enough, but there is other nations like the heart of democracy, Greece, which went into collapse, and then, of course, there's the upheavals in the Middle East, the so-called Arab Spring. It certainly seems that we're in transition everywhere. We got uprisings and declines going on. Does this mean that we're going to change our business models? There was a lot of talk about the fall of communism as it was labeled when the Berlin Wall came down. But is it really that the polarity and the triangulation, might I add, between communism and capitalism, the nations who hold these things and compete against each other are really going to find a new paradigm where that's not our polarity anymore? Are we going to just seek an alternative to all of that? Is that any signs of that?
Well, I think that the very asymmetric economic experience that you're seeing between the owners and, you know, senior leaders of capitalism versus the general employee is going to cause some, you know, there's going to be some change. And I don't know if that is achieved through increased corporate taxation of corporations or what. But to me, it is not sustainable in a period of prolonged weak confidence for corporate profits to be at record levels over and over and over while you have so many people and underemployed.
Yes, and you know, large institutions can become self-generating, and then, you know, we tend to serve businesses, we tend to serve monarchies, we tend to serve governments, we tend to serve any large institution once it gets beyond a certain size. And then it's patterns and patterns, and they grow to a certain point, and then they have a death, and the new system takes its place, and there's a revolution or what have you. We're certainly going through these patterns all the time. But I do believe that the world is in transition right now, and the world in which we were born is not the world that we're living in right now. It's like the great book, The World is Flat. There's less nationalism, there's less boundaries. Everything is more an interconnected network, and rather than the old models of hierarchies, military-style flowcharts for how businesses work and communities work within states, work within the nation, and everything could be lined up with just a power and dominance hierarchical pattern. But now everything is more multifaceted, a polycephalous network of intercommunications is what I like to call it. And that seems to be that the sunrise companies are moving more towards that, and the sunset companies are sticking with the old patterns. But anyway, one thing's for certain. What we're going to see in the next 10 or 20 years is far different than everything that we have seen. And in order to understand how it's changing, we're really going to have to look at what's going on around us. And that's why I'm excited why people like you are pointing out the facts that we can meter the change around us simply by keeping our eyes open to the herd. What hunter would go out into the woods and not know the pattern of every creature that it was hunting, not know the patterns of the buffalo, not know the patterns of anything that it was hunting? It wouldn't catch anything. And yet we might blunder into the market as if we were throwing darts on a dartboard and hope that we're going to hit or miss or follow some technical indicators that themselves are very good, but don't tell the whole story because it's one piece of the salad. And when we understand our mind, heart, and body together, we can understand more. I think you're bringing some light to this, Peter.
Well, I think that for a lot of investors, you know, they had been told that asset allocation made understanding cycles unnecessary. That if you, you know, had diversified stocks and bonds, then those cycles would be, you know, down cycles in one place would be offset by up cycles in another place, and that over time you would make money. In a 30-year bull market in interest rates, that probably is true. But I think that we're at a point now where understanding cycles, and I'm not to say, you know, people should be, you know, market timing, but recognizing that there are natural cycles to investments and sectors and industries, and taking advantage of those cycles and managing risk against those cycles makes a lot of sense.
Amen. It makes perfect sense. Absolutely. And once you recognize that, once you grasp that, it's like you can't not see it after you realize that we are herd-like people, that we move in rhythm, there are trends, there are tides in the affairs of man, and that's certainly going to show up in the market. If people wanted to get in touch with you and find out more about your business or learn or read your book and so forth, how would people get in touch with you, Peter?
They can get in touch with me through my website, www.financialinsights-between-them, and insights, INSYGHTS. The goal of my firm is to explain why.
Indeed. The least asked question, the people ask who, what, where, when, and how, but we often overlook why. And that's why we have surprises in the market, and that's why we have sudden downturns, and we have panics, and we have crashes, and so forth. And I do believe that some of the pain could have been taken out of these crises if we asked why. I'm not saying that we won't have trouble and that we won't have ups and downs, but we can certainly lessen the trauma. We can foresee things coming if we ask why. And I think that you're one of the key people who has learned how to ask why and is telling us about that. Your book, Peter, Moods and Markets, is where do people go to get your book?
They can get it through Amazon.com, through BarnesandNoble.com. Both sites carry it. And it's available in electronic form as well as physical.
Well, I sure understand the language you're talking, Peter, and I thank you for the edification that you've brought to our listeners. This is a lesson for us all. The main lesson of anybody who studies cycles is that they are a part of everything around us. Don't ignore them. You got to know the tides, you have to know the currents, and you have to know the trends. And you're one of the people that's helping us. Peter Atwater, Financial Insights, author of Moods and Markets, thank you for joining us tonight at the Cycles of Change radio program. I've certainly enjoyed it.
Thanks, David, very much.
Indeed. This is David Katzmeier signing out, and I ask you to join us next Thursday when we explore the world of cycles and how it affects everything around us. Good night, and thanks for listening.